Welcome to our first Conscious Cat Ask the Vet teleseminar. I'm Ingrid King, the human behind the Conscious Cat and the author of Buckley's Story, Lessons from a Feline Master Teacher. For those of you who don't already know me from either my book or from the Conscious Cat, I'll just give you a brief background about myself. I'm a former veterinary hospital manager turned writer. My online magazine, News for You and Your Pet, goes out to subscribers around the world. My blog, The Conscious Cat, has been called Educational Catnip for the Cat Lover and is a comprehensive resource for conscious living, health, and happiness for pets and their people. Many of my articles on The Conscious Cat focus on cat health, and I'm so excited to be able to give you this opportunity tonight to ask your cat health questions and get answers directly from the cat vet. I would like to take just a couple of minutes to talk about some housekeeping here. When I open the call up to your questions, you can raise your hand, so to speak, by pressing 5-star on your phone. I will be able to see that on the screen that I'm looking at. And since I can't see your names, only the phone numbers you're calling from, I will call on you by using your area code. And if we have more than one person from the same area code, I'll just use the next 3 digits of your phone number. But don't worry, I won't announce your entire phone number. I am recording this conference, and I'll make the recording available on the Conscious Cat in a day or two. And now I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. Fern Crist. Dr. Crist grew up as an Army brat. Her family moved frequently, and being an only child, she would often turn to animals for companionship. Since frequent moves did not mix well with owning pets, the teenage Dr. Crist got her animal fix by getting a job as caretaker for the lab animals in her high school biology lab. She took care of all sorts of rodents, snakes, reptiles, and amphibians, and even a tarantula. In 10th grade, she managed to convince her parents to get a cat. That was Shadowfax, a huge Russian blue who was her soulmate for the next 13 years. Dr. Crist earned both her undergraduate degree and her veterinary degree from the University of Georgia and graduated in 1982. The town of Athens was a hotbed for new music in those years, and Dr. Crist, a fan of jazz rock fusion, worked at the college radio station as a DJ for much of the time she was in Athens. After graduating from vet school, she experimented with a number of pursuits and discovered by accident that she loved the adrenaline rush of emergency work. She spent 7 years as an avid practitioner of emergency medicine, even serving a term as the secretary of the newly formed Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care Society. Eventually, though, she felt the need to see the sun and decided to find a place in the daytime world. 3 years of general small animal practice at a large hospital made it clear to her that cats were where it's at. She opened her own cat hospital in 1993 and has rejoiced in feline medicine ever since. She is an active member of the American Association of Feline Practitioners and has served 2 terms as a board member there. Dr. Crist is married to a brilliant scientist with whom she shares her deep love of science fiction and exciting technologies. They have 2 wonderful children, a son and a daughter, 3 cats, 3 rats, and 3 koi fish. Dr. Crist is currently on sabbatical to care for her mother, who is succumbing to Alzheimer's. Welcome, Fern.
Hey there, Ingrid. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well tonight.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a vet?
Well, I didn't actually always know, but I think I knew earlier than most people did. When I was about 12 and living in a very small town in South Georgia, I adopted a little stray kitten who died as a result of eating poisoned baited meat that was put out to kill the packs of dogs that ran around the area. And I think the experience of losing that little kitten, didn't really scar me for life, but it certainly informed all of my life choices thereafter.
Okay, and what made you decide that you wanted to work with cats exclusively?
Oh gosh, you know, I had always much preferred working on cats just because I love touching them, I love being around them. It's always, the cat has always been my pet of choice. But when I got into medicine, I realized that cats were more interesting because they're harder to figure out. They're more of an intellectual challenge, and they are extremely good at hiding things, and that really just excites me. I love solving puzzles. I'm a crossword puzzle fanatic. I love anything that involves making a diagnosis based on insufficient evidence. It's just fun. And cats are much more fun in that regard to me than dogs are.
And I did a little bit of research, and what I came up with was that cats have become the most popular pet in America. But statistics about veterinary care for cats show that even though cats are considered members of the family just like dogs, pet owners take their cats to the vet far less frequently than their dogs. In 2006, dog visits averaged 2.3 times a year, cat visits only 1.1 times a year, with significantly more dogs, 58%, than cats, only 23%, seen by veterinarians. Why do you think that is? Why are cats so underserved when it comes to veterinary care?
Ooh, I think that's a multifactorial situation. Probably the most important part of that is something that I've already mentioned, is that cats hide their problems very, very well. It's part of the nature of cats, because they're not nearly as domesticated as dogs are, that in the wild, a cat, if he is injured or hurt and shows it, is going to become the prey rather than the predator. And that behavior has been domesticated out of dogs largely, but not nearly so much out of cats. So we find that cats, when they are not feeling well, will tend to do what I think of as meatloafing. They just sit around with their paws hooked up under them.
And, I love that term.
And many people just attribute that to, you know, cats don't move around very much, or they sleep a lot when they get older. And they, you know, folks write it off quite reasonably to what are often misapprehensions about normal cat behavior, because there is very little overt symptomatology. There's not always the groaning and moaning sort of thing that if a dog has an abscess tooth, he'll practically point his paw at his mouth and say, "This hurts, ow, take me to the vet." And a cat will just get into that little meatloaf position and curl those paws up underneath of her and look at you and go, "I'm fine." And because of that, many owners, even owners that know their pets very, very well and care about them deeply and see them every day, which is, in fact, sometimes makes it harder rather than easier, will miss things that are going wrong. So that's one of the reasons I think that we have fewer cat visits than we have dog visits. Another reason is because to this day, and it's a sad thing, but it's true, hopefully changing, in the world of small animal veterinary medicine, cats are truly second-class citizens. They are less researched. They are less taught in the vet schools. Most continuing education for veterinarians will be an entire day on something having to do with dogs, and at the last 30 minutes of the program maybe, "Oh, and by the way, in cats, it looks like this." Mm. And for those vets who are still sitting there, they may hear that and they may not, because it's the end of the day. So we have less science out there for cats, and it makes it a little harder to figure things out. There's also, because of the second-class citizen thing, there's an underemphasis on preventive medical care for cats in the quote-unquote mixed practice, which is the phrase that we cat vets use for practices that see dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm.
In most of those practices, I find, not all by a long shot, but I'd say the majority, dogs simply have more recommendations made for them, more time spent with them, and certainly more money spent on them. But if you move into a cat practice, you'll find that without the dogs present, cats will actually stack up as having more visits and more spent on them over the course of time than an average dog will.
Interesting. So since cats are so good at hiding problems, it makes sense that, you know, they don't get taken to the vet maybe quite as quickly as a dog. But what about preventive care? What do you recommend as a good basic preventive health program for cats?
I think that the recommendations that are out there now put out by the American Association of Feline Practitioners which have recently been updated, have for quite a while now been recommending that cats see the vet at least once a year from their young months up to about age 7, and then twice a year from then on out till whenever their life is over. And obviously more frequently than that if there are specific health problems that need to be monitored, finessed, managed, tested, that sort of thing. There's some new recommendations out that suggest that cats should just be seen twice a year lifelong. And I'm not sure I disagree with that. I find overall when I'm looking even at younger cats and doing wellness screenings on cats who have absolutely nothing in their history to suggest that there's a problem and nothing on exam to suggest that there's a problem, and it just amazes me every day how many times I will do wellness lab screening on a cat like that and find a problem. It's much more frequent than people realize.
And I would imagine that because cats are so good at hiding illness and hiding symptoms, that it's especially important to catch things through lab work or blood screens before they even show symptoms, so that things can be treated before they become a problem.
Absolutely true. In so many cases, if we can identify the problem before it becomes overtly symptomatic, before the symptoms are just right out there obvious and in your face, so to speak, our chances of being able to cure or at least successfully manage are much, much higher than if we get to the point where things are so bad that the cat can no longer hide it from the owner. That's generally a situation where a disease process has progressed a long way down the road, and it's going to be that much harder to bring the cat back.
Yeah. Well, I think all of us on this call know that cats are mysterious beings, but it sounds like that extends to their medical care, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open it up to questions. If you joined us a little bit later, if you have a question for Dr. Crist, you can press 5-star on your phone, and that shows me on the screen that I'm looking at that you have a question, and I'll call on you by your area code. So if there are any questions, don't be shy. Go ahead and let me know. Okay, we have area code 954. Oh, wait, I got to unmute you. Hold on. Sorry, area code 954, you have a question?
Hi, Fern and Ingrid. This is Nancy calling from Florida.
Hello,
Nancy. Hi, I was just listening in, and that was really almost shocking to me to hear how less researched cats are and that they are so much less taught in vet school. And that just made me think that if I'm not a cat owner, but if I were, I would certainly hesitate to take a cat to a vet who mostly specializes in dogs. And I was just wondering, how did you become so well studied as to specialize as a cat vet? I just think it's absolutely fascinating that you chose to do that. And I'm assuming you must have done a little bit more than they gave you in your vet school about.
I would say that's safe to say yes. Well, to begin with, when I got my first cat hospital in 1993, I pretty much at that moment decided that I would stop studying anything other than cats. So God forbid you should bring me a dog or even worse, a horse or a cow to look at. Now, I'm not sure what they look like anymore. So by becoming so specialized and you know, burrowing down so deep on the one species, I've given up the depth of knowledge and the breadth of knowledge that I would have had to adequately treat anything else. And I'm fortunate in that I entered the field at a time when not only the American Association of Feline Practitioners, but several other veterinary continuing education societies had begun to really provide a lot of quality continuing education for the feline vet community. And there are actually now quite a plethora of textbooks out there that are specifically feline. Now we have feline oncology textbooks. We have feline ophthalmology textbooks, things that when I was in vet school, which was, oh gosh, a century or so ago, I would never have dreamed we would see. And it's so wonderful to have those things now. But I do all of my reading and all of my continuing education on the cat and nothing else. And I do a lot of it, so that's how I get there.
Well, thank you. That's really informative, and your area certainly is lucky to have you there.
Oh, thank you. But you know, I'm only one of many. We're really fortunate here in the greater Washington area, that we actually have, the last time I looked, which was pretty recently, we have the highest concentration of feline veterinarians in the world in the greater Washington area.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? We have some really, really terrific cat vets in this area, men and women that I am just honored to call colleagues. And you know, I couldn't ask to be in a better area for it. If I ever run up against a case that I'm not sure what to do with, there's a dozen people I can pick up and call and run and have a cup of coffee with, just, you know, that close by, that I can kick a case back and forth with and get some great input if I need it.
Great. Thank you, Fern. Could I change the subject and get in one more quick question for my daughter?
Sure, go ahead.
She has an older cat, and the cat sleeps with her at night and purrs and purrs and purrs a lot during the night. And the cat usually sleeps up by her head, and she tries to nudge it down under the covers to her feet or whatever just to have some time without the purring. And I was just wondering, like, why do cats do this? Why do they purr so much, especially at night when they should be sleeping, or is that part of their sleeping?
It's not part of their sleeping, but it's certainly part of their happy, contented place that we all like to try to go as we're moving into a state of slumber. And cats, being naturally nocturnal creatures, will tend to be a little slower to fall asleep sometimes at night than we are. You know, it's odd that my husband is dealing with the same thing right now. Our oldest cat has decided recently that he's going to sleep on top of his head, and periodically when Phantom, that's the cat, not my husband, when Phantom wakes up during the night, he will groom my husband. So he will lick the hair on the top of his head, and he will try to lick and pull out the little whisker hairs, which you can imagine my husband is, you know, jumping up and down and screaming at the top of his lungs. But the bottom line to this is that sometimes the behaviors that we think of as problems like that are not only just normal cat behavior, but sometimes they're really great, wonderful cat behavior. Purring to me when I'm going to sleep, if I have a cat next to me purring, that's the most soothing thing in the world. And so I think that in a situation like that, you really have to say, well, what would it take to make it stop? Do I have to lock the cat out of the room? Do I have to wear earplugs? Do I have to go through this whole training regimen? Or would I be better off retraining myself and my response to it? Because it's fundamentally a pleasant and happy-making thing for the cat. Probably the best answer is to try to make it a pleasant and happy-making thing for her, too.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love how you switched that question around. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Anybody else with questions? Go ahead and press 5-star on your phone. Okay, while we're waiting for people to decide what they're going to ask, I'll just jump in with a question that I have. What is the disease you most frequently see in cats, Fern?
Oh, gosh, I'd say that's a toss-up between two that I see in, I would guess, 80 to 85% of the cats that walk through my door on a given day. And one is obesity, and the other is periodontal disease.
Wow, those are totally two that I didn't expect. That's really interesting.
Obesity is pandemic in American cats right now, and that has a great deal to do with the diets, but it also has a lot to do with our fundamental misperception of what a normal cat physique should be. Americans are getting fatter, and our cats are getting fatter too, and we seem to think that heavier is better. A larger burger on a plate must be better. A bigger cat must be better too. And sometimes it comes from the loving them to death. You know, I can't be home all the time. I don't have the time to play with my cat, so here's a bowl of food. And they get fat. Periodontal disease, which is one of the hidden scourges of the cat world, is every bit as damaging to the entire body as periodontal disease is in the human world. And it is, of course, going to be more of a problem in cats and dogs because we're not brushing their teeth and flossing and mouthwashing twice a day like we do with ours. And that plaque and tartar and nastiness just builds up. And with some cats, it doesn't build up so fast. With some, it builds up very quickly. Some cats have secondary systemic inflammatory disorders that cause their gums to become much redder because of the presence of the plaque and the tartar than other cats would. But no matter which one of those examples fits your cat, overall, the chances are very, very good that when you bring your cat to the vet for a wellness checkup, the vet, if they're looking in the mouth, is probably going to notice some tartar and some periodontal disease. Pretty rare not to see it because it's built up for all cats. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I know a lot of people are afraid of the whole idea of having a dental procedure done, having their cat's teeth cleaned, because there's anesthesia involved.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, anesthesia and the risk versus the benefits of dental health?
Absolutely. One of my favorite topics, actually. Anesthesia, back when I graduated from vet school in the last century or so, was a very, very scary thing. They taught it to us with tremendously close monitoring because the anesthetic agents that we used at the time were just so terribly bad that anesthetic deaths were pretty common. We were also pretty bad back then at identifying pre-existing illnesses that would put animals at risk for problems resulting from the suppression of the cardiovascular system under anesthesia. Well, we are a lot better at that now, and the anesthetic agents are hugely better. And we've learned in the succeeding 30 years or so since I graduated, it got shorter, did you notice, that we can use what's called balanced anesthetic regimens. If we use a design for each cat, an anesthetic regimen that uses several different drugs in a calculated mix, we get the best part of each one of those drugs and minimize the side effect of each one. And we can also pick and choose which drugs we're using based on any pre-existing conditions. For instance, if we have a cat that is in chronic stage 2 renal failure, we may want to choose drugs that are not processed out of the body primarily by the kidneys, but rather kind of outflank the kidneys and use the drugs that go out through the liver instead if the liver's working well. And with all of those considerations in mind, and also the fact that we can now monitor anesthesia with our kitties at very nearly the same level they do in hospitals with human beings, we look at blood pressure, we look at oxygen levels in the bloodstream. We look at heart rates. We look at body temperature, just constant readouts on everything all the time. So if there's a problem developing, we know it immediately and can do whatever's necessary to try to countermand that at that time. So now that we have anesthesia, both in the sense of evaluating the patient prior to and then the art of doing it, down to a very, very exact science, the rate of anesthetic deaths in practices where this is done well is never zero, but it's extremely low. Then you have to take that and you have to balance it against the question of what is the danger of not doing anything about periodontal disease? That is a question that needs to be asked more often, because the danger of not doing anything about periodontal disease is huge. Bacteria from the mouth can get in through the inflamed gums and be carried through the bloodstream all over the body, causing low-level infections everywhere that it lands, that the immune system has to run around and put fires out all the time. That's very, very draining of the energy of the animal that's being affected this way. And you can end up with chronic infections in the heart valves, in the kidneys, and in the brain even, any organ in the body that can just sort of simmer on at a low level for a long time and then pop out and become really problematic when you least expect it. And that's only one problem with periodontal disease. The other one that people often overlook is pain. It hurts. And since cats are hiding things really well and they're not pointing to their mouth going, look, Mom, I have an abscess tooth, this hurts, they're just meatloafing and saying, yeah, I'm fine, whatever, let's watch the
meat. And it seems like a lot of cats, even with pretty severe periodontal disease, actually never stop eating, which always amazes me, because to me that seems like it would be so painful.
You would think, but I think this really highlights the difference between acute pain and chronic pain. Cats who are in acute pain will not eat. Cats who are in chronic pain will eat right up to the very end. And periodontal disease is by its very nature a chronic disease. So it doesn't keep them from eating, but it certainly will actually cause them to lose weight, even if they eat normally, because the chronic infection that's going on in the gums and elsewhere in the body will increase the resting metabolic rate, increase the calorie requirements, and if they don't eat more to meet that, they'll get thinner.
Okay.
Not in a good way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that there really is, the bottom line really is with the anesthesia and the worries that most, you know, pet owners have about that is that it's a question of risk versus, you know, where's the greater risk? Is it the anesthesia or is it the dental disease? And
in a nutshell,
the ramifications of the dental disease.
That's exactly right. I think in the last few years, the only cats I've seen where the answer to that question clearly came down on the side of don't do the anesthesia were cats that had very, very severe, nearly terminal heart conditions, and cats that had very, very difficult bleeding disorders, where any kind of bleeding would be hard to stop. There's a whole list of this. In one of those cases, I can recall, we even had one cat where the teeth were so bad, and the bleeding disorder was almost insurmountable. We ended up doing a nearly full-volume blood transfusion immediately prior to the dental work in order to
apply
clotting factors, and then did the dental work. And that went fine, but it was a rather exciting day on the road.
Sounds like it. everybody on the call, if you have any questions, simply press 5-star on your phone and let me know that way. I can see that on my screen. And while we wait for people to, you know, let me know that they have questions, what you just said about, you know, the day when you did the trans. Oh, wait, we have a question. I'll just save this for later. We have, I'm trying to unmute, area code 571. You have a question?
Hi, this is Renee. I have a question about feline dentistry. Are you finding that there are specific breeds that are more predisposed to dental issues? And also, how often do you find on the average that dental cleanings need to be done?
Oh, what good questions, Renee. And thank you for listening, and thank you for being here tonight. Yes, there are absolutely breeds that are predisposed, and I would say that in general, it would be the breeds that have been around the longest and are probably the most inbred. I have a horrible little suspicion that a lot of this comes from the fact that at cat shows, the judges don't look at their teeth. They look at the cats for all kinds of things relating to beauty, but very rarely to health, which which is, I think, a real problem for the breeders, because if they are breeding specifically for physical characteristics that are quote-unquote pretty and not culling based on health problems, well, the obvious result of that is that you're going to get more health problems, and dental disease is certainly high on that list. The breeds that just jump out in my mind, Maine Coons, Persians, Himalayans, pretty much anything with Persian or Himalayan blood in it. Those are probably the biggest ones, but there are certainly others that are breed related. And in general, to answer your second question, I would say on average, in the early years of their lives, up to about age 7 or 8, most of the cats I see these days probably need to have their teeth cleaned on a yearly basis, on average. And when I say on average, I mean that there are some that I need to clean 4 times a year, and I still see the occasional cat who gets up to age 14 and has teeth that look like Tony Curtis in the original Around the World in 80 Days when he looked at the camera and smiled and there was a little ding of bright, you know, and they've never had their teeth cleaned at all. And you wonder, how in the world did they do that? God dealt that cat, that particular cat, a much better genetic hand in the teeth department than he did me. I'll tell you that. In general, once a year in the younger years. As cats get older, starting at around age 7 to 8 and moving on past them, we start to see an increasing incidence of mature cat disorders, almost all of which are characterized by some level of chronic dehydration. That's going to decrease saliva flow, and it's going to increase the rate of buildup of plaque and tartar, and hence the periodontal disease that goes with it. So as we get into the older years, ironically, rather than wanting to do less anesthesia, I typically want to do more, because these same cats that are getting their periodontal disease more rapidly also are more susceptible to the negative effects of having that periodontal disease be in there. So I want to get rid of it.
That makes a lot of sense.
Does that answer your question, Renee?
Very much so. I appreciate it. Thank you. Great information.
Thank you very much.
I have a follow-up question, and then we'll go to area code 954, who has another question. What can cat owners do to prevent dental problems?
Wow. I'm going to give you some answers that are going to turn the world on its head. probably the first and best thing you can do is feed canned food. did everybody just go, what? I thought you were supposed to feed dry food. Dry food.
Well, if they've read The Conscious Cat, it shouldn't come as a surprise to them.
Well, you know, we were taught for years that dry food was better for their teeth, and it's just recently been shown that that's not, in fact, the case, that dry food actually does stick on the teeth more and creates more adhesion of food particles and more tartar, more plaque, whereas canned food has more, because of the water content, kind of washes the mouth as the cat's eating the food, and there's not as much stuck on afterwards. So canned food, better for the teeth. I would love to say that brushing the teeth is the best thing you can do, and in a purely theoretical world, it would be. The truth is that taking an adult cat who has never had her teeth brushed and training her to accept a toothbrush, not an impossible task, but definitely an arduous one, and for some cats it is, for all practical purposes, impossible. If you can start when a cat is very, very young, 8 to 10 weeks, and make it a fun, pleasant experience by giving treats afterwards or what have you, chances are at least decent that you'll be able to get some toothbrushing done. But in most cases, what I find is that people give it their all, and they come to me and they say, I tried everything I could, and it's just not working. And I say, well, here's the thing. you can't ruin your relationship with your kitty, because mm-hmm. we have them so that we can love them and they can love us. And if they
yeah.
run away and hide under the bed every time they see us coming because they know that darn toothbrush is coming out, then why do we have the cat in the first place?
Yeah.
So it becomes, I think, sometimes just ruinous for the relationship, and it's better in those cases to just say, okay, we're going to get the teeth cleaned however many times a year, be that once a year, once every 3 years, twice a year, whatever it takes, and we're not going to be brushing. But if we can introduce any kind of not brushing, but physical rubbing of the teeth, one thing I've been very successful with is to have people wrap a little bit of gauze around their finger
mm-hmm.
and just insert that finger inside the cat's mouth between the lips and the back teeth and rub on the outside surface of the back teeth, which is where most of the problem usually is. And I find that just that mechanical abrasion, just a little bit that you get from a soft gauze, can frequently get me very, very good results over time. I can take a cat that might need teeth cleaning 2 or 3 times a year and make that cat be once a year, or mm-hmm. once a year and take that cat to twice a year, or every 2 years.
Every other year, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. But I guess, again, it comes down to if it's a question of, you know, the cat dreads you coming at him with the gauze around the finger versus the benefits, you still have to do that. Yeah.
And blow it off. I mean, really, everything has to be based on the question of, do we have a happy relationship?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
if the relationship is ruined by whatever we're doing, then we need to figure out something else to do.
Yeah. Okay, we have another question from Nancy.
Hi. Since you mentioned obesity right along with the periodontal problems that cats have, I was wondering about my friend's cat who is obese and whose vet put them on a prescription food to help him lose weight. However, it doesn't seem that he's losing any weight, and he seems to be always hungry. What would you recommend for cat owners whose cats need to lose weight?
Oh, I'm smiling a really big smile right now. I'm so glad you asked that question.
Thank you.
Can I just tell you, Nancy, that I had a cat. I still have him. In fact, he's running around here chasing a toy as I'm speaking to you, who was 25 pounds up until about 3 years ago. And I had him on every prescription diet with every method I had ever been taught in the cat world for getting him to lose weight. And he just wasn't losing weight. This is my cat. This is, you know, I'm the cat expert. I'm the cat vet. I'm counseling all these people on how to get their cats to lose weight. And I've got the obese cat. Oh, how embarrassing is that, you know? And I became very intrigued with the theory behind the current movement toward grain-free and low-carbohydrate diets in cats, the theory being that cats were not evolved to eat carbohydrate-based diets. They are obligate carnivores, and this doesn't mean that they eat pure muscle meat. It means that when they eat a mouse, they eat the whole mouse. They eat the skin, they eat the brains, they eat the bones as well as the muscles, all the organ meats, which are very rich in many vitamins. And there's just not a whole lot of rice, grain, or sweet potato in that mouse. And if you were to design a diet that would emulate that mouse, which is the cat's natural prey, as well as you possibly could, it wouldn't be zero in carbohydrate because the mouse does eat grass seeds and this and that. So when the cat eats the mouse and he eats the cat's guts, he's going to eat what's in those guts. So there will be a little bit of grain or little plant fibers and things in there. But the percentage of that compared to the rest of the mouse is about how much there probably should be in cat food. And then I started looking at the work that had been done, looking at the difference between cats that had been fed these high-protein diets and cats that were fed diets that were based ingrained, where everything else is the same, all of the micronutrients are the same, all the vitamins are the same. The only thing that's really different is where is the calorie coming from? Is the calorie, the balance of the calories coming from carbohydrates or from proteins? And in the cats who ate carbohydrates largely, they found that the intestinal microflora, the bacteria that live in the guts, was entirely different. And the gut activity was different. It was slower. And the digestibility, the amount of the food that was digested was different because it sat in the gut longer. It's not coming out the other end in the 2 hours that is the normal gastric transit time for a cat from front end to back end. And carbohydrates are much more easily broken down. So these cats that are eating carbohydrates are getting what you might think of as a sugar rush compared to a protein diet, a blood glucose spike, which then drops just like yours might after a candy bar, creating hunger and a need to go back and nosh some more. So very interesting. So you get these prescription diets that are built the way you would build one for a dog, which is an omnivore like we are. And you say, okay, I'm going to take this diet and I'm going to put a lot of fiber in it. I'm going to make it lower in fat and lower in protein and higher in carbohydrates. And we're going to feed specific amounts of it and we're going to lose weight doing this. Well, it works for humans. It works for dogs. It doesn't work for cats. And you know, it shouldn't be a big surprise because cats are not omnivores. So if you take a cat who is obese and you feed this cat a grain-free, low-carbohydrate diet, and if you use the cat's very own systems, the normal cat brain will, if given a high-protein diet, will be satiated in less than 20 minutes, no matter how much is in that bowl. They'll eat until they're full, and then they'll stop. And so if you take this cat, you feed this canned, high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet, and you allow the cat access for 20 minutes twice a day. They can eat however much they want in that 20-minute period, however much they can shove down, because their brain is going to tell them to stop eating when they're full. But no nibbling in between and no carbohydrates to give that sugar rush. Eventually, and sooner rather than later, you're going to end up with a slim, fit-looking cat. And I'm going to come back now to my own cat, this 25-pound monstrosity that I had tried on all of these prescription diets that are designed and for dogs and work well in dogs but do not transfer well to cats. And I took this guy, first one I did this with, and I put him on my what is now my practically my mantra, 20 minutes twice a day, canned, grain-free, low-carb cat food. And he lost 3 pounds in the first 2 months that I had him on the diet. And he is now, he's a big cat naturally, but he is now at 17 pounds and looks like he should be on the front of the Cat GQ magazine.
Oh, no.
he not only is slim, but he's also fit because when he lost the weight, he got more active and he's bouncing around, chasing things and having fun now instead of just lying around all the time. And I didn't do a thing except 20 minutes, twice a day, canned, grain-free food. An amazing thing. As I expanded that to my clients, I found that almost without exception, it worked as well for my clients' cats as it did for mine.
Thank you. That was an excellent detailed question. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for asking it. I've been very excited since realizing what a boon these new grain-free diets are and hopefully will be even more in the future as people start to realize how great this is to cats. And the results that I'm seeing from getting my clients, my patients on this stuff is just terrific, really exciting.
We have a question. Thank you, Fern. And I guess I should jump in here and say that, you know, I've certainly seen this work with Amber, and those of you who read The Conscious Cat have followed Amber complaining about her diet, but at the same time, she has been on all the, you know, so-called prescription weight loss diets over the course of her life, and they didn't work. And when she was put on the grain-free canned food, she actually finally started losing weight. We're still working on the 20 minutes twice a day. That's been a little bit of a challenge. But once we can get that implemented, I think the weight's going to come off even quicker. We have a question, area code 703-430. And I need to unmute you. Sorry about that. Go ahead and ask your question.
Oh, hi, Ingrid. This is Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
I'm glad the subject of food came up because there's so many brands and varieties. And I'm trying to kind of settle into a, you know, something that I can be, I don't know, I'm just, I go to the pet stores and there's shelves and shelves and shelves. Is there a specific type of food that you recommend, the grain-free? I mean, it's, you know, it's difficult, you know, to be able to stand there and read all the labels and figure out which ones might be the best ones to use. Do you have a recommendation?
Ain't that the truth? Well, before I answer your question, and thank you for asking it, because, yes, I do, but Ingrid, am I allowed to say food names?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
I do it too, so yeah, go for it.
Okay. Just wanted to be sure I wasn't going to do anything.
I guess I should jump in and
get
say
you
this
trouble
is,
here.
We are not getting paid for this by any of the brands that will be mentioned.
No, and I don't own stock in any of these things, although I did sometimes. Yes, the two brands that I have been using myself for quite some time now, Evo, which I think is quite arguably the best cat food on the market at the moment, makes four different flavors of canned, grain-free, low-carb food, which are superb. And they also make what I believe is the only grain-free and low-carb dry food that anybody makes, although I'll caveat that statement by saying that the pet food industry is probably one of the most profitable industries in the world, and there are when the pet food industry perceives a niche appearing in the market, they move to answer it with a rapidity that you would not believe, and there are literally new grain-free foods coming out in the cat world every day, so much so that the term grain-free is now being used to cover up the fact that sometimes people are just pulling grain out and shoving in replacement forms of carbohydrates such as potatoes and peas and so on, because it's a lot cheaper and more profitable to make cat food with carbs than it is with protein. But that having been said, the Evo I love. The other one that I really, really love right now is Wellness. Makes a line of grain-free canned foods, which is actually very hard to figure out, because the only thing on their little cans that differentiates the grain-free cans from the ones that aren't is a little tiny yellow triangle that says grain-free. And if you don't look for it, you're not going to see it. So you do have to look close. But there's about 7 or 8 flavors that they make of the grain-free stuff, which is just tremendous. Wellness also makes a quote-unquote grain-free dry called Wellness Core, which is better than most of the dry foods on the market. However, Core does fall into the category of one of those foods that has, yes, it is grain-free, but they've pulled out the grain and replaced it with potato as a carbohydrate source. So it's still nowhere near as low-carb as the canned Wellness is. Paul Newman's company has come out with 3 flavors of grain-free canned food recently that looked very good. Blue Buffalo has a couple. I looked at a new one today. Ingrid, help me. What was that?
The company is Life Abundance, and the particular food is the canned cat food, which they call, I think it's Instinctual Choice.
Instinctual Choice. I think that was it. Yes, Ingrid
had
emailed me to ask me about
it.
And I looked it up for her, and it was very impressive. The ingredient list looked beautiful, and I thought yeah, if I can find that stuff, I'm going to feed it to my cats.
And I have to say, my two little taste testers, Amber and Allegra, inhaled it, so it's cat approved.
Half the taste test.
These are often not the easiest things to find. You won't find them in the grocery store, and you frequently won't find them in the large chain pet stores because of the low profit margin. They're expensive to produce, and they don't have very much of a markup, so the people that sell them don't make a lot of money on them. So typically you're going to find them at either the mom-and-pop pet stores or, oddly enough, Weber's Feed seems to be a place that a lot of people tell me that they find these things.
Yeah, I have seen also someone's mentioned to me a brand of food called Instinct.
Yes.
Yeah,
now,
I've used that
that's
too.
All
that's
the line of the
Variety is the company. And it's, yeah, the Instinct line is really good, and it doesn't have the potatoes or the other carbohydrate fillers in it.
Yeah, because what I'm using now that you say the potato, it does have that in there, and I don't know why I didn't even think that would, you know, I mean, I know that potato is a carbohydrate. Why would I? But I was initially using IMES, which I stopped, and I started using the Natural Balance, but that has potato in it. And, but my cat did seem to cut down on how much food they were eating when I switched over to the Natural Balance, probably because there's, even though it's potato, maybe there's less carbohydrates.
Less of it, and so you're not getting that same sugar spike followed by the hunger pangs, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really good point, Debbie. I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of times what I hear when I recommend the grain-free canned food is that, well, it's so expensive,
mm-hmm.
but you raise a really good point. If they eat less in the long run, it probably isn't.
Right. Well, my issue came up when I started fostering kittens and I was integrating with adult cats, and I had trouble keeping each one out of the other one's food. So I was trying to find something that everybody could eat by recommendation and not have to worry about, you know.
Oh, yes. And you know what? The grain-free foods have, moving into that area, has been a beautiful simplifier for that particular issue, the life stage thing. You know what? When cats are kittens, they eat mice. When they're middle aged, they eat mice. When they're old, they eat mice.
Mice, yeah.
You know, if you design a food that is going to be what they normally eat, then that's a food for all their life stages. Now, is it necessarily the right food for every cat? Are there diseases out there that in fact do need some nutritional alterations? Absolutely there are. But the whole idea of kitten food, adult food, old cat food, blown right out of the water, I think. If you get your good grain-free, low-carb foods, you don't have to worry about that.
I just wish I could afford to feed my ferals outside good food. I can't afford it.
I know.
Well,
so your ferals are supplementing their diet with cat with mice and voles. So
that's
yeah,
true.
Well, I don't know if these cats would know how to catch mice, because I feed them. I've been feeding them since they were babies at my front door, so I don't know if they would know how to do that or not. But anyway, thank you. You answered my question wonderfully. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for calling.
Sure.
And it looks like we have time for one more question. It looks like we have another question from Renee. Whoops, I need to unmute you. There we go. Renee, did you have another question?
I do, kind of along the lines of diet, I think. I hear a lot of people saying that their cats have been diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease.
Oh,
I'm wondering a couple things. Is this something that's on the increase, or is this something that maybe non-feline oriented veterinarians are picking as kind of a diagnosis of the decade, or what? What is your general feeling?
Ah, wow. I need to stop saying wow, don't I? The third disease on the list behind obesity and periodontal disease, and possibly taken as a whole, maybe the first actually, is the whole family of inflammatory diseases in cats. Inflammatory bowel disease, pancreatitis, hepatitis, chronic renal failure, even all the cancers have inflammatory components. There's just slews and slews and slews of them. And so many, in fact, that you really have to look at the population of domestic cats and number of inflammatory diseases that they have and say to yourself, if these cats were out in the wild with the same percentage of the population having these debilitating inflammatory diseases, would cats even exist? And I think the answer is probably, well, not very well. Inflammatory bowel disease, to cut to the chase here, is being more and more associated with grains and carbohydrates in the diet. There is not solid scientific proof of this yet, but there are studies being done, and there's definitely science out there that points in this direction. And I personally am of the opinion that when all the data is in, we're going to find out that we've been giving our cats a lot of these inflammatory diseases by changing their intestinal flora, by feeding them foods that were never meant to be in a cat's intestine. And when we allow the intestinal flora to go back to its normal state by changing the diet back to the high-protein diet, we often see a lot of this inflammation clear up. One of the quickest ways you can tell is the hairball, the quote-unquote mere hairball, which is now being heralded as the first and most common sign of inflammatory bowel disease. Cats should not be barfing hair. In the normal world that they lick, they groom, they swallow hair, it should pass right on through. And the only reason that it wouldn't is because the intestinal motility is negatively affected, and that's what happens when you get inflammation in the gut. So rather than treating hairballs with distilled petroleum products, which is another thing that should never go in a cat gut, what we should be doing is letting the gut flora go back to the way it normally is, letting the normal state of the intestine reassert itself, and the vomiting stops.
Wow, that's really amazing that there could be such a simple solution to it's a pretty devastating disease.
And
for the
pandemic.
Cat and from a management point for the owner.
Absolutely pandemic. And it's not a single organ disease. In fact, no inflammatory disease in the cat is. When the intestine is inflamed, so too is the liver, so too is the pancreas. They may not be inflamed to degrees that you can measure easily from the outside, but they are. So too are the pads and the nose and the gums and the skin. Mm-hmm. And every single thing that adds to inflammation, such as additional unnecessary vaccinations, parasite loads, heartworms, things like that, will increase general inflammation, and they will exacerbate ongoing chronic inflammatory diseases. So it's important to look at the whole cat and do what you can to keep all sources of inflammation down to as low as you possibly can.
Okay. Renee, did that answer your question?
Well, it did, and I guess I'm thinking about folks who've told me that they've been advised to give fiber supplements, you know, to their cats, it just amazes me that so many, I'm just going to come out and say it, that there are so many people in the veterinary profession that really don't understand management of cat care.
It's true, but it's also very much the result of deep, long, many years of training that we've all had. I probably wouldn't be detaching myself from those traditional views if I hadn't been out of school as long as I have and if I didn't read as much as I do. It takes a long time to untrain yourself from things that we've been taught that were wrong. And that's not just cat medicine. That's every branch of science. Every branch of science has changed in the last 50 years. And you know, much of what we knew was wrong, and much of what we know now will turn out to be wrong. We just have to be able to change and move along with that.
Can I ask another quick question?
Do we have time?
Sure, but quick one. We're almost at the end here.
Yeah, I guess just, you know, given the increased popularity of cats in households as pets, do you see a trend in veterinary schools toward more training toward feline medicine, or is that just not in the near future yet?
Oh, it's happening now, and thank goodness for that. Yes, the kids that are in school right now, kids, huh, I was an adult when I was in school, but now they're kids. They're definitely getting a lot more direct cat medicine and science than, well, I had zero, so that will tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that is happening now, and thank goodness for our kitties that it is.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Fern, I want to thank you for a fascinating hour. We really learned a lot about cats today that I know I didn't know, and I hope that a lot of the listeners also learned some new things about how to keep their cats healthy. And I want to thank everyone for joining us. Before we wrap this up, let me just make sure that everyone has my contact information. My website is ingridking.com, and you'll find links to the Conscious Cat and my Facebook and Twitter pages there. You'll also find sign-up information for my mailing list where you can sign up for news for you and your pet. And if anybody on the call feels like they didn't get their question answered, if you want to send me an email, I'll try to forward them to Dr. Christ, and if she has time, then I'm sure she will be happy to try and answer them, unless it's something so involved that it really requires your own veterinarian's intervention. Would that be okay, Fern?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then just one quick thing, our next teleseminar is going to be on May 11th. It's going to be titled Inspired and Inspiring, The Rewards and Challenges of Living with Disabled Pets. My guest will be Mary Schaefer, the editor of Almost Perfect, Disabled Pets and the People Who Love Them, and Barbara Teckel, the author of Frankie the Walk and Roll Dog and Frankie the Walk and Roll Therapy Dog Visits Libby's House. Mary and Barbara will talk about how their disabled pets have changed their lives in ways they never could have imagined, and you'll get an opportunity to ask questions or share your own stories. It should be a very special evening, and I hope you'll be able to join us. So thanks again, everyone, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.